Welcome to Chemistry of the Mind, unlocking the brain's secrets. Today, we're diving deep into the fascinating world of adrenaline and the amygdala, exploring their intricate roles in fear, anxiety, and even memory.
It's a complex interplay, isn't it? This fight-or-flight response, so essential for survival, yet so often implicated in the challenges of modern life. Where should we begin?
Well, let's start with adrenaline itself. It's more than just a rush. It's a precisely orchestrated chemical cascade. Synthesized in the adrenal medulla, this hormone acts on nearly every tissue in the body, binding to those adrenergic receptors.
Alpha and beta receptors, right? Each with distinct effects, mediating everything from blood flow and heart rate to the glucose metabolism. It's remarkable how such a tiny molecule can have such widespread impact.
Exactly. And it's not just about physical responses. Adrenaline plays a crucial role in memory consolidation, particularly for emotionally charged events. It's like a highlighter for our experiences, ensuring we remember what matters most, sometimes to our detriment.
That's a great point. Think about PTSD, for instance. The heightened adrenaline response during trauma can lead to incredibly vivid and often distressing memories. It's a double-edged sword, that memory enhancement.
Absolutely. Now let's shift our focus to the amygdala, the brain's fear center. This almond-shaped structure is constantly scanning our environment for threats, real or perceived.
And it doesn't just react to fear, does it? It seems to be involved in a wider range of emotional responses, from pleasure to anxiety, and even social interactions.
Precisely. And the different nuclei within the amygdala, like the basolateral and central nuclei, each have their own specialized roles. It's a complex network with connections to the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, and other key brain regions.
So how does this all tie together? How do adrenaline and the amygdala work in concert to produce the experience of fear?
Well, imagine encountering a dangerous situation. Your senses perceive the threat, sending signals to the amygdala. The amygdala then triggers the release of adrenaline, preparing your body for action. Your heart races, your breathing quickens, and your muscles tense, all thanks to this intricate interplay.
And that's where the fight-or-flight response comes in, right? It's a primal mechanism honed over millennia of evolution, designed to help us survive in the face of danger.
Exactly. But in today's world, those same mechanisms can sometimes backfire, contributing to anxiety disorders and other mental health challenges. It's all about context and how our brains interpret the signals they receive.
So it's not just the presence of adrenaline or the activation of the amygdala, but the meaning we ascribe to those experiences that determines whether we perceive fear or anxiety. It's the story we tell ourselves, so to speak.
Precisely. And that's where things get really interesting, because it opens up possibilities for intervention. If we can understand how these mechanisms work, we can develop strategies to regulate our responses to manage fear and anxiety more effectively.
So it's about rewiring those neural pathways, about learning to interpret those signals in a more adaptive way. That's a powerful concept, and one with profound implications for mental well-being. And it all starts with understanding the chemistry of the mind.
So we've established that adrenaline is key in our fight-or-flight response. But how exactly is it made? It's not just, boof, there it is, right?
Right. It's a fascinating process, actually. It all starts with noradrenaline, which gets transformed into adrenaline thanks to an enzyme called phenylethanolamine N-methyltransferase, or PNMT for short.
PNMT. Got it. And where does this enzyme hang out?
Primarily in the adrenal medulla, although interestingly, it's also been found in small amounts in the heart and brain, which makes you wonder about its role beyond the fight or flight response, doesn't it?
It does. So what triggers the release of adrenaline? Is it just any old stress?
Well, a variety of stresses can trigger it. Physical threats, excitement, loud noises, bright lights, even extreme temperatures. It's all processed in the central nervous system.
So the brain gets involved then, not just a simple reflex.
Exactly. And there are two main players that stimulate adrenaline synthesis: adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH, and the sympathetic nervous system. They both work by increasing the activity of enzymes involved in catecholamine synthesis.
Catecholamine synthesis. That's the pathway that produces adrenaline, right?
Precisely. And ACTH also stimulates the release of cortisol, which further boosts adrenaline production.
So it's a cascade of hormones, each influencing the other.
Yeah, a real chain reaction. Then the sympathetic nervous system, through the splanchnic nerves, directly stimulates adrenaline release from the adrenal medulla.
Oh, how does that work?
Acetylcholine, released by the nerves, causes cell depolarization and calcium influx, which then triggers the release of adrenaline into the bloodstream.
Interesting. So the adrenaline is stored and then released on demand.
Yes, in these chromaffin granules. And for noradrenaline to be converted to adrenaline, it has to be transported out of these granules, then back in after the conversion, all thanks to a protein called VMAT1.
VMAT1. Another piece of the puzzle. So once adrenaline is released, how is its action stopped? Does it just fade away?
Not exactly. It's mainly terminated by reuptake into nerve endings, some dilution, and metabolism by enzymes like monoamine oxidase and catechol-O-methyl transferase.
And what about regulating adrenaline levels? Is there a feedback mechanism?
Unlike many other hormones, adrenaline doesn't downregulate its own synthesis, so abnormal levels can occur in certain conditions like pheochromocytoma, or even with surreptitious adrenaline administration.
Surreptitious? You mean like injecting it?
Exactly. Now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about the amygdala. This almond-shaped structure is fascinating.
It really is. It's more than just the fear center, right? It's involved in a whole range of emotions.
Absolutely. And it has these different nuclei, each with their own specialized roles. The baselateral complex, the central nucleus. It's a complex network connected to other key brain regions.
Like the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex. So how does it actually process fear? What happens in there?
Well, let's imagine you encounter a threat. Your senses pick it up and send signals to the lateral amygdala. This triggers a cascade of events, eventually leading to a fear response.
And what about the different hemispheres of the amygdala? Do they play different roles?
Yes, there's some evidence suggesting lateralization of function. For instance, the right amygdala seems more involved in processing fear-inducing stimuli, while the left may be linked to the reward system.
Interesting. So it's not a monolithic structure, but rather a collection of interconnected parts, each contributing to the overall experience of fear.
Precisely. And there are also differences between male and female amygdalae, both structurally and functionally.
So we were talking about the different nuclei in the amygdala and how they have specialized roles. But it's not as simple as, say, this nucleus is for fear and that one's for pleasure, is it?
No, not quite. It's more nuanced than that. While some nuclei might be predominantly involved in certain emotional responses, there's a lot of overlap and interaction between them. Take the central nucleus, for example. Lesion studies show it's important in appetitive learning, but that doesn't mean it's the only area involved in reward.
Right. And the baselateral amygdala, traditionally linked to fear, also plays a role in appetitive learning, particularly in associative learning involving pheromones, like in that study with the mice and the male soiled bedding.
Exactly. The naive female mice, initially attracted to the non-volatile pheromones, learn to associate them with the male-derived volatiles, which then become attractive too. It's a fascinating example of how the baselateral amygdala links different sensory inputs to create a learned preference.
So the baselateral amygdala is acting as a sort of integration center connecting the vomeronasal and olfactory systems. And this learning involves the reward system, right?
Absolutely. But even there's a difference. The primary pheromones activate the baselateral amygdala and the nucleus accumbens shell, while the learned attraction to the volatiles involves a wider circuit, including the prefrontal cortex and the ventral tegmental area.
Oh. So the brain processes these different types of rewards through distinct pathways, even though the baselateral amygdala is involved in both.
Precisely. And it's these projections from the baselateral amygdala to the nucleus accumbens, especially the D1 receptor-dependent ones, that seem to drive motivational salience, that wanting aspect of reward.
I see. So it's not just about liking something, but about being motivated to seek it out. And the amygdala plays a key role in that process.
Yes. And it's also involved in memory consolidation, particularly for emotionally charged events. Remember those studies with stress hormones? Administering them after learning enhances memory. And the amygdala, especially the baselateral nuclei, mediates this effect.
Right. It's like the amygdala tags these experiences as important, making sure they're stored more effectively. And this ties into the whole fear and anxiety aspect, doesn't it? Because those emotionally charged memories can sometimes be traumatic.
Exactly. Think about PTSD. The heightened emotional response during trauma, mediated by the amygdala, can lead to incredibly vivid and persistent memories. And this brings us to another fascinating area, the connection between the amygdala and anxiety disorders.
Yeah, there's a lot of research there, isn't there? Smaller amygdala volumes in children with anxiety, hyperactivity in the amygdala in social phobia and depression. It's a complex picture, though. Like, how does the amygdala's role in fear relate to conditions like psychopathy, where there's a reduced response to fear cues?
That's a great question. It suggests that it's not just the amygdala itself, but its interactions with other brain regions like the prefrontal cortex that contribute to these complex disorders. And there are other factors too, like individual differences in amygdala structure and function, even differences between the hemispheres.
So we've been talking about the amygdala and adrenaline and how they're involved in fear. But it's not just about immediate reactions, right? There's also this whole aspect of fear, learning, and memory.
Exactly. Think about Pavlovian fear conditioning. You pair a neutral stimulus with something aversive, and eventually that neutral stimulus alone can trigger a fear response. It's classic conditioning, but with fear as the conditioned response.
Right. So like the famous Pavlov's dogs experiment, but instead of salivating at a bell, they're cowering in fear.
Precisely. And this conditioning is incredibly powerful, even across generations. There's evidence suggesting that conditioned fear can be inherited, which is mind-boggling, really.
Inherited fear? Wow. So, like, if a mouse is conditioned to fear a certain smell, its offspring might also be afraid of that smell, even if they've never encountered it before.
Yeah. It's transgenerational inheritance, and it involves epigenetic changes, alterations in gene expression that don't involve changes to the underlying DNA sequence. It's like a molecular memory passed down through generations.
Fascinating. So where does the amygdala fit into all of this?
It's central to the whole process. Lesions in the amygdala, particularly the basolateral amygdala, disrupt fear conditioning. The neurons there are crucial for forming those fear memories.
And what about the central amygdala?
That seems to be more involved in expressing the fear response, the actual behavioral manifestation of fear. But it's not a simple division of labor. There's a lot of interplay between different nuclei within the amygdala.
So it's a complex network with different parts contributing to different aspects of fear, learning, and memory.
Exactly. And it's not just the amygdala working in isolation. The hippocampus is involved too, especially in contextual fear conditioning, where the fear response is linked to a specific environment or context.
Oh? So, like, if you were attacked in a dark alley, you might develop a fear of dark alleys, even if they're in a completely different part of town?
Precisely. That's the hippocampus at work, linking the fear memory to the specific context of the alley. And the anterior cingulate cortex comes into play for long-term storage of these fear memories. It's a dynamic interplay of different brain regions, each contributing to the overall experience and memory of fear.
And what about the molecular mechanisms underlying all of this? What's happening at the cellular level?
Well, there's a lot of fascinating research on gene expression and epigenetic changes during fear conditioning. Immediate early genes like EGR1 and DNMT3A2 are upregulated in the hippocampus and an amygdala after a fear conditioning event.
IEGs, those are genes that are rapidly transcribed in response to stimuli, right?
Exactly. And they play a crucial role in synaptic plasticity, the ability of synapses to strengthen or weaken over time, which is the basis of learning and memory. These IEGs can affect DNA methylation, which can then influence the expression of other genes involved in memory formation.
So it's like a cascade of molecular events triggered by the fear conditioning experience that ultimately leads to long-term changes in the brain.
Precisely. And this also ties into the development of anxiety disorders. If these fear memories become overly generalized or persistent, they can contribute to conditions like PTSD and phobias.
Right. So understanding these mechanisms, these intricate interactions between the amygdala, hippocampus, and other brain regions is crucial for developing more effective treatments for these disorders.
Absolutely. And it all starts with understanding the chemistry of fear, how these molecules and neural circuits work together to shape our responses to threat and danger.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on Chemistry of the Mind. We hope you found this exploration of the brain's fear factor as enlightening as we did. Until next time, stay curious.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure being here. And to the listeners, goodbye and take care.